So I'd like to begin just by appreciating all of your efforts today. And as we were saying yesterday, I know many of you, this is the first time to come to Gaia House, the first time to do a retreat like this. And for others, you know, returning to somewhere that's more familiar. But it's really significant, important, I think, to take a moment to appreciate the loveliness, the goodness of what we've been doing today, and to be reminded that the things that feel more difficult, challenging, you're not on your own with those. They're very much part of what it is to be on retreat. I imagine there may be a few bodies that are noticing you've been sitting all day. Some people might be feeling that in the back or the shoulders, the knees, elsewhere. Minds that may have felt very busy, even surprisingly busy, can show up when we're arriving on retreat. Feelings of sleepiness, tiredness that can be around, and many other things. But just really taking time to sense, yeah, this is a good thing to be doing, and I really feel that. I really have a confidence that this is such a worthwhile thing that we're creating together. You can also sense how much you've supported other people by being here. You give me the opportunity to show up as a teacher, which is nice. You may think, oh, if I'm not on retreat, I just kind of sit at home and sit and walk and then say all these things. I don't, of course, do that. There's some part of me that comes alive when I'm doing this thing, and I really like that. I also wanted to reflect a little on the different ways we can understand what we're doing when we're practicing on a retreat. And there might be many personal, individual reasons for coming. Some of us may have a sense that this is a path that's leading us from confusion to wisdom. It might be one way we could see what we're doing here. We can see how in our everyday life, in our minds, sometimes we can be quite lost in different states of mind that arise, different impulses that propel us in a direction that we may not always want to have gone in afterwards. A sense of life sometimes, yeah, feeling confusing, full of struggle. And so then there's this image of wisdom, of clear seeing, of clarity that can be really inspiring, and that may be expressed by these figures, Kuan Yin and the Buddha behind. Can bring up that sense, there's a wise way of being in the world. There's a path through the confusion. Sometimes I've also thought about being on a retreat as a way of moving out of a taken-for-granted way of living. And some days, certainly again for me personally, can feel like that, where it just feels a bit more like, oh, here I am again, what am I doing today? Okay, got to get up, answer those emails, do this, see that person. But we're kind of going through life in a way as if it's all a bit sort of taken for granted, it's all a bit routine. And being on a retreat, I think, is a way of waking up a sense of wonder, sense of beauty. And yeah, not so much taking life for granted, even, you know, this breath that comes and goes. We can begin to savor and appreciate the breath. I think this is a very supportive and helpful place to do retreats. I think the surroundings here in the building, they carry so much that can really evoke that for us. You know, just delight of being able to walk outside today, how it's been. This was my first doorway into meditation, actually. It was reading a book called Zen Buddhism and Psychoanalysis, and it was talking about an experience of looking at a flower and seeing the flower in a new way. And I went outside of my house and started looking at the trees and things differently, and then there's suddenly this sense of, wow, it's amazing. Look at this tree. It's hard to put that into words, you know, what that meant, but it was like, you know, suddenly I was seeing a tree as if it were for the first time, and it just felt extraordinary. And we can get that experience too, can't we, when we go abroad. You know, you go abroad and you notice the street signs look interesting, and this, I don't know, the way people are dressed or what they're doing, it can kind of awaken this sense of not taking things for granted. And of course the people who live in that place are often just carrying on as if there's nothing there. Our practice can also open up a much larger perspective on life. I think it really helps us to do that. You know, not to be so caught up in what might feel immediate or superficial. You know, those times in life where you find yourself worried about something that maybe in the big scheme of things, as we say, doesn't matter so much. And again, being here, certainly it's a clear night, looking at the stars, you know, gives that sense of the big scheme of things. And our practice, in a way, is also a way, I think, of holding all of our everyday concerns in these larger perspectives, larger sense of time and space that can be opened up. And people also talk about practice as involving a shift of identity from that kind of small and narrow, constricted sense of self that can arise to, again, something much more spacious. And spoken of in different ways sometimes, you know, in terms of not-self. We let go of these particular narrow images of who we are. Some traditions talk about, you know, true nature, things, these kind of words. A shift to a much more spacious and vast sense of who we are. So again, we don't need to pin down our kind of sense, oh, I'm, you know, this way of looking at the path, that way of looking at the path, but it's helpful to see that there are different approaches and perspectives we can take, and to maybe then shed some light on the assumptions that we might be bringing as we arrive on a retreat like this. One vision of the path that I've personally found very helpful comes from Carl Jung via Tara Brach. Tara Brach quotes Jung. And Jung says, this is Tara Brach saying, in contrast to orthodox notions of climbing a ladder, seeking perfection, psychologist Carl Jung describes the spiritual path as an unfolding into wholeness. Rather than trying to vanquish waves of emotion and rid ourselves of an inherently impure self, we turn around and embrace this life in all its realness, broken, messy, mysterious, and vibrantly alive. And I really like this sense of practice being more about wholeness than perfection. More about wholeness than perfection. And you might sense, as you've practiced today, you know, where there's some assumptions, programs that can be there in the background. Like, I'm here because I'm not quite good enough as I am. And so I need to do this sitting and walking, and I might somehow improve myself, you know, seeing the whole thing as a self-improvement project. If I do enough of this, I'll be some kind of better version of who I am. Or I'm here to get rid of the parts of myself that really shouldn't be here. I shouldn't have this habit, shouldn't have that habit. That thought needs to go. You know, shouldn't be having that emotion. But that way of looking at our experience as if, you know, there's this that belongs and that that doesn't belong and this needs fixing and that, you know, needs sorting out, can create a kind of restlessness in our practice. It's like we're kind of here doing the practice, coming back to the body and the breath, but in the background there's this sort of program of, oh, I'm, you know, doing this as a way of improving myself or somehow trying to perfect. And I have found when that pattern has arisen in my practice, you know, this idea of wholeness, so significant. We're including all kinds of things. We can be with all the different emotions that arise, all the different thoughts that arise, all the different states of mind that come and go. So our practice then isn't so much about getting rid of things, but a sense of spaciousness, holding all that comes and goes, seeing clearly all that comes and goes. And so, with these ideas in mind, I wanted to talk more about some of the particular more difficult states of mind that tend to arise in meditation, but seeing them really through that lens that we've been talking about, really, yeah. So not seeing these as somehow personal faults or personal problems or things we need to eradicate, but actually seeing these patterns as part of a human life, part of human experience that we can learn to respond to wisely, skillfully. So you may have heard this teaching on what are traditionally called the hindrances, but you've seen these patterns perhaps arising today. So as I talk about these, this is the thing that really brings it alive. Not some distant theory, but stuff that we've probably seen today. Most of us, there are five of these by the way, and most of us, certainly including me, have probably had a taste of all five today, by the way. You may, one or two may have been stronger than others. I find it actually a very inspiring teaching to reflect on these more difficult patterns that can arise, because they're not just in meditation, they're in life generally. And if we can learn to be with these energies, these patterns, skillfully, it's hugely transformative in our life. Hugely transformative. And if they're not seen, if they're not held wisely, then they can really create a lot of distress and suffering for ourselves and others. We'll see as we talk through them. But the first of these is sense desire. Sense desire. But you may reflect today, you know, have there been moments where the mind has been saying, I want something else, I want to be somewhere else, something different, something better, something improved? This is the kind of feel of sense desire. You know, underneath the experience, there's some sense that right now is not where it's at, we might say. You know, whatever life is about, it's not this moment. It's something else. That's the basic feel of it. And the something else could be all kinds of things. Maybe there's some kind of train of thought about a holiday. Yeah, you know, I wish I was on holiday. It would be nice to go to south of France rather than Guy House. And oh, that would be nice. And seen that. It might be a particular person. Possibly the strongest or one of the strongest feelings of sense desire can arise, of course, if, you know, if we're maybe in a very new relationship, or we want to be in a very new relationship. We may know what that's like, and that the feeling that life would be so complete and wonderful with the presence of this person, and without that person there's just a sense of absence or loss. Yeah. We can get it, of course, in terms of things that we want to buy. And we live in a society that is incredibly skillful at triggering sense desires. If we didn't have that tendency enough already, there's lots of people who are going to help us out and think of lots of things we can have that towards. Something shiny and new and different. Uh, But the idea of this is that alongside this sense of that kind of pull towards something, there can be a kind of underlying assumption there that it's going to be really satisfying, it's going to deliver something. That's the view that goes with it. It's not just, oh, that might be nice, but it's as if it's going to really be satisfying. But notice what that does to this moment. So alongside the sense of the sense desire arising, really intimately connected together with it, there's a sense of lack. The sense of lack of this moment. Yeah. So when I'm dreaming of being in the south of France, the other side of that coin is that being here at Gaia House is not enough. Yeah. Or when we're thinking of being with a particular person, then connected with that at the same time, being on our own or with someone else in this moment, that's not enough. Yeah. So it's very significant and skillful to start to see this as a pattern, and we'll do this with all of these hindrances, because if we believe it, I mean, if you really started to believe this one about the holiday, then you would probably get up and go. You know, if we really bought into the whole thing, yeah, no, this is no good, what I need to do is get on a plane, be in the south of France, and then I'll be happy. If you really believe that. But being on a retreat where we're temporarily saying, well, we're not going to follow this, gives us a chance to look at what we had previously simply been driven by. And this pattern, you know, something else, somewhere else, some other time, is so pervasive in our lives. And so the opportunity to turn and look at that is a real gift of a retreat. You might have wanted shorter sittings or longer sittings or more guidance or less guidance or spicier food or less spicy food. You know, a harder bed or a softer bed. The opposite quality is called ill will and is associated with aversion. And I see these first two as really a pair. So sense desire is wanting. It's this sort of energy. It's pulling something towards me. If I can hold it and cling onto it, then everything will be okay. And aversion, ill will, is pushing away. Pushing away. So if sense desire says, if only I had X, Y, Z, then ill will says, if only I didn't have X, Y, Z. There's some feeling that I need to get rid of something. But it's a very, very similar pattern. And at the same time, both of them are telling the story that this moment is not enough. This moment is not okay. It would be okay if I could only get rid of. So again, you might reflect, where's that turned up today? It would be okay if only I could get rid of. Those thoughts may not have been there explicitly, but you can sort of feel that movement in the mind. It might be something like a train of thought, a repetitive train of thought. That definitely turns up on retreat. I remember once when I used to work at college and came here on retreat, spent about the first 3 days continuing to have an argument in my mind with one of the managers. So it was an interesting example of ill will, but you know, in a way, probably a double ill will. There was certainly some degree of ill will towards this person, but also then towards the thoughts. You know, oh, if only I could stop thinking about that. You know, that was difficult, but now I'm, you know, hundreds of miles away. My Gaia House, just gonna stop thinking about it. Yeah. But that pushing away energy, this is the tricky thing in our practice, it tends to have the opposite effect, doesn't it? The more that we try and push away those thoughts, the more that feeds the sense of them being solid and obstacles that are in our way. Of course, we can feel that too with sensations in the body. You know, if only I didn't have this aches in the legs, only my shoulders weren't so tense. And again, the opportunity here is to be able to see this, to look at it, and to recognize this as a pattern in the human mind. So these aren't personal flaws or issues. This is really significant, because a lot of the extra struggle we create around them is the sense, oh, there's something about me. What is it about me that has this pattern, that pattern, and the other pattern? But to see, actually, these are tendencies of the human mind. Already that's a different perspective on them that we can see and respond to. The next one of these is sometimes translated as sloth and torpor, or we might say sleepiness and drowsiness. I was talking to some people in the group about this today. I mean, in my experience in talking to many, many people who've come on retreat, it's incredibly common to feel really tired in the first day or two. And this, by the way, is not a sort of classical teaching I'm giving now. This is the benefit of my hard-earned experience here. But my sense is really that in that first day or two, we just need to rest more. We just need to rest more. I think there's a feeling of, you know, so many of us, our lives can be full, can't they? Taking in a lot of stimulation, a lot of responsibilities, doing many different things. And we're kind of keeping going. You know, maybe lots of coffee and all that. And so then, you know, you're stopping when we're not doing that. We're not so busy. We're not running around. I think quite naturally there's a in response. So for me, this is very much now just part of the process of retreat, that it's very usual, normal to be really pretty tired the first day or two. And so, again, we know there's no need to make a problem of that. It's just our bodies going through that process, our minds going through that process, and we can rest. And then generally we find, oh, there's some more energy that comes as we feel more rested. At other times, this sleepiness and drowsiness can be more a kind of pattern in the mind that can be a way, sense a way of kind of turning away from difficulty. Or so in those occasions, a little bit more energy and curiosity can be really helpful to see, well, what's underneath this tiredness? What's underneath this kind of drowsiness? And on retreat in life and in life, I think there's a huge art in knowing the sleepiness that needs activity and the sleepiness that needs rest. Yeah. I think actually in life and practice, we need really both of these. You may know that, for instance, when people have low mood or if they have depression, some degree of activity is really significant and helpful to lift the mood. You know? And those of you who studied MBCT again may well be aware of this. That's why in MBCT there's the section on using activities, you know, nourishing activities. So again, we can see that similarly here. There may be sometimes when there's a sleepiness coming in, that actually, although the minds may be saying, ah, just rest more, actually sometimes the opposite energy is really helpful, skillful. Yeah. You might want to put a little more energy into the posture or open the eyes a bit, or do some standing meditation, walk a little more quickly. So there are ways we can respond to these patterns when they arise. The fourth of these is called restlessness. So again, this is like a pair. If sleepiness, drowsiness, not quite enough energy, maybe restlessness can be too much, or feel like it's not kind of held. And you might feel yourself moving a lot in the meditation, you know, the hands are turning one way, then the other, oh, let me try them there, back in the first place, that was good. What do they do on the Zen retreats? Thumbs together, let me try that. But that kind of shifting and quickly trying to find something different can feed the restlessness. And again, this principle of doing the opposite of what the hindrance says at times can be very skillful. So if you notice a lot of restlessness, you can have this intention really to be still. And to see that impulse to move. And you can stay with it, stay with it, stay with it. Oh, and then there might be a settling. But if we continue to move, then that can be feeding that quality. And then the last of these is called doubt. And doubt as a hindrance is nothing to do with critical questioning or really using our intellect in a way that is liberating, freeing. It's nothing to do with a kind of deep questioning of things. It's much more a kind of unconscious pattern in the mind that you notice, and the kind of the words of doubt would be something like, oh, you know, this is all right for everyone else, but I don't think you can do this. You're not up to this. Or I don't think this is the right kind of meditation for me. I think I need to do something different. Or, oh, this is the wrong time. I've come at the wrong time of year. It would have been better for me to come at another time. And all of these little thoughts and voices that can be around. And again, it's very significant to see these simply as doubt. You can know it as doubt. And that is putting us in a place where we're not believing it. We start to see it as a pattern, so we're not buying into it. Yeah. And I always find it's helpful then to have a sense, again, in terms of this doing the opposite, to have a sense of commitment. And the commitment can be, you know, for this sitting, it's important in a way not to make it too big. If it's too big, it feeds the doubt. You say, right, I'm going to practice for 3 hours a day for the rest of my life. It might well feed thoughts like, oh, do I really want to do that? But you're saying, right now, I'm here to give myself to this practice. This is not the time to wonder whether it was a good idea to come or not. Yeah. So there can be a clarification of intention. It can be really helpful. Or you might think again, well, what is it that I love about this? Can actually arouse some faith and delight. What is it I love about this? I mentioned them earlier because it works for me. It will be the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Tutu, because I really love the film of them, which you'll probably hear me mentioning a few times this week. But for me, that's almost more than words as well, because it's like, you know, why do I do this meditation? And then if you think of the two of them who have lived through such incredibly difficult situations, you know, living in exile or living in apartheid South Africa, and decades of struggle and difficulty, and yet to have such joy and humor and love and compassion, lightness. It's possible for a human heart. You see, again, for me, bringing that to mind now, the doubts just sort of kind of goes with it. Like, okay, that's it. So you can use skillfully these things. So I've said a few things about how to respond to the hindrances, but another teaching that, in my understanding, has many, many layers of depth to it that we can continue to work through is the teaching of rain, which is a particular way of thinking about how we can respond to hindrances. So rain stands for recognize, allow, investigate. The N has different meanings depending on who you talk to. I'll come to the N later. Get confused with that. But recognize is the first one. Now, when you really ground attention in the body, like we've been doing today, feeling the feet on the ground, feeling the body on the chair, feeling the breath in the body, this grounding the attention, mindfulness of the body, can really help create a space where we can recognize thoughts, feelings, states of mind that up until that point had been simply taken for granted. Use this phrase, haven't I? We recognize what we've been previously governed by. And this is really significant. Let's take the example of ill will and anger. So we've probably all had the experience where you're talking to someone and you can see that they're really upset about something, they're really irritated or angry about something. And you say, you know, what's happening? What's wrong? And the person says, oh, I'm fine, nothing's wrong. Yeah, again, quite a kind of archetypal kind of conversation, that, isn't it? But that moment when we realize that maybe we're feeling irritated or angry or annoyed is actually very freeing, because before we do that, we think, oh no, I'm. It's not that I'm in an angry state of mind. It's just that person's wrong, and this is in the wrong place, and that shouldn't be there, and this is no good, and that's broken. So we're just seeing the world through that pattern. And it's, okay, there's some ill will here, some annoyance here. Can you see that already opens up a kind of space? We can look at it. We can see it. In the Buddhist scriptures, the hindrances are often personified as the figure Mara. So this sense of recognition is like when the Buddha says, I know you, Mara. I know you, I see you. See you. I can see this pattern. And then the A of RAIN stands for allow. And this, in my own practice, took me quite a long time, I think, to really sense what this allowing was about. Because I think I heard the word hindrance, and hindrance sounds like an obstacle, a bad thing, so it makes sense that you just need to get rid of it. And actually this allowing is the opposite idea, so that these patterns, they don't need us to tense around them and try and push them away or say they shouldn't be here or condemn them or condemn ourselves for them arising. But actually, what they need more is a sense of space. Can I let this be here? Yeah. This is, again, in the connections with MBCT, why we use Rumi's guest house poem. It really speaks of this sense of allowing. Yeah. You can meet and all of the things that arise. We can even use words like this belongs. Or right now, this is how it is. Yeah? We can use the breath to breathe with it. So we're meeting these patterns in our embodied experience, yeah? Giving them some space. And that then allows us to move to the I, which stands for investigate. And you could also say that means to be curious. Because investigation can sound a little bit like we're going to try and work it out in our mind and try and sort of trace it back. Well, where exactly did this come from? But in this practice, the investigation is generally more of a sense of curiosity that's not exclusively, but primarily around how. Yeah, how does it feel in the body? So the investigation isn't really a why. It's not, why do I feel like this? But a how. How does this feel now? What's happening in the throat? What's happening in the shoulders? What's happening in the chest? How's the belly? We're dropping the attention below all of the thoughts and stories. And how does that feel right now? And this is again very significant, and again there's links to this in the 8-week courses. What we quite often do unconsciously is a difficult pattern draws us into a train of rumination. Again, we'll talk about this more as the retreat goes on, but this is one of the mechanisms where a sad mood becomes a more lasting low mood or depression, is this kind of rumination that comes in. And that rumination can have the quality of like, oh, why am I like this? Why am I always so sad? Why have I been so sad? And our minds can bring up all the other times we felt sad before. And you see how that can actually, you know, lead us downwards. We feel sad today. You know, I mean, if I say it to you now, it's obvious, isn't it? If you feel sad today, is it also helpful to think about all the times you've felt sad over all your life and bring those up again? Yeah? So the investigation isn't like that. It's much more how. How is it feeling? And so we develop a more subtle sense of these patterns in the body. We start to see them as bodily patterns. You might also sense a belief. So although the eye we can think of as primarily to do with the body, sometimes it's also interesting to think of as, is there a belief present here? And good ones to watch out for this week are, and this is going to ruin my retreat. Yeah? Watch for that. Or it's cousin, you know, and it will be like this all week. Because if you, let's say your back is aching, most of the time, difficult to say all of the time, but most of the time we can think, okay, this is unpleasant, but I can be with it now. Yeah, it's unpleasant, but I can be with it now. But then the thought, and it's going to be here for the whole week, and it's going to dominate my retreat, and it's going to be there. It's that belief that's going to turn that unpleasant sensation into something that just feels like, oh, this is just too much. And it's interesting, actually, again, you think of often on the 8-week courses, we talk about being aware of thoughts, sensations, emotions, feelings, these different levels, that you may notice in when these patterns are there that we're more drawn into one of those levels than others. So again, the investigation can be what else is happening. If we're very aware of the thoughts, what's happening in the body? If we were very aware of some body sensation, is there some belief there? You know, what's the feeling around this? And then I mentioned the N. So we get to the N of rain. And as I said, different teachers actually use it to stand for two slightly different things. Well, two different things, actually. So I'll tell you both, because both are really helpful. So in Tara Brach's version of this, she calls the N nurture. And what this means is that in the midst of this pattern, we bring very deliberately more kindness and care to ourselves. And there are many ways we can do that. And one way often used is to place a hand on the heart. And you can feel you know, the warmth of the hand, maybe just moving that slightly. And what we're doing then is we're giving to ourselves the kind of care that we might at other times give to another person. You know, if a child has fallen over and hurt their knee, you might comfort the child. Oh, it's going to be okay. Yeah. So nurture means, and again, this is in a sense a whole path of practice, isn't it? But we're cultivating that inner voice more and more, the capacity to, in times when we're in pain, also be the one who can soothe the pain. Yeah. And we could do that with words too, like, oh, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. Or it is okay. I don't know how many of you have done these kind of practices, but they can feel, at first you think, oh, I'm not used to doing that, but actually it can become rather lovely. You really become such a good friend to yourself. And another way into this is actually to imagine a good friend. You can bring a friend to mind, or the person that we were practicing with in the metta practice, the easy person. And seeing how it is to bring that image to mind. And because really, what this is pointing at is that so much of our painful experience, what it really needs is to be met with love and with care. Yeah. Doesn't need to be fixed or analyzed, dissected, but met. Yeah, met. Love and care, warmth. We can meet those more tender parts of ourselves. And then in the original version of RAIN by Michelle McDonald and others, the N stands for non-identification. And so again, you can really see this too as part of the outcome of this practice, that we are shifting the view, or the view is shifting from these hindrances, what we might call hindrances, as somehow essential parts of who I am. I'm an angry person, you know, I'm an indecisive person, I'm this kind of person, I'm that kind of person. We're shifting from any of those telling fixed and final stories of who we are, and we start to see them as patterns. As Christina Feldman has said, you know, without self-view, the hindrances are just winds. Just winds. So they're passing through. And we see that they're not solid. They're changing, moving. They're impermanent. They're not self. They don't define us. And that shift of view, again, which is a very significant part of what we're exploring this week again, is so freeing. We're moving from this whole perspective that here I am with all of these difficulties and patterns and neurosis, and I've got to sit here on the cushion and somehow get to the bottom of it. It's like, there are these patterns. That's what's here now. It's okay, can be with that, breathe with that, be curious, investigate, allow. My sense is this RAIN teaching has a lot of, a lot of depth to it actually. You may have heard it before, some of you may have heard it many times before. But my sense is that actually it's describing a practice that we can really deepen in and explore in more and more subtle ways. This is so much of what we're doing here when difficulties arise. We recognize what's here, we're making space. We're being curious rather than bored or uninterested. We're learning to be with difficult experience with a sense of care. And then this shift of view, it all comes to be seen as arisings and passings, as a pattern, thoughts and feelings and sensations that come and go. Then discover spaciousness and freedom around, even in the midst of these patterns. Again, this image that sometimes used, it's like when you remember you're the ocean and you can be with the waves. Yeah? You can remember you're the ocean, you can be with the waves. And that's all these hindrances are. So, I hope this is useful and supportive as you continue to notice these patterns arising. And when they do arise, you can think, yeah, wow, opportunity to explore, to learn, to see, and to meet them in these ways. So let's just sit together quietly for a minute or so. Mm. So, yeah, there's no need to remember all of the details of the talk. Maybe if there's something that feels significant, meaningful for you, stay with that. And taking what feels helpful, supportive.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.